I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Later in the hour, we'll, of course, check in Haiti with a heartbroken longtime aid worker there. But first, we turn to Massachusetts, where we are, and where the Senate seat held by the late Ted Kennedy for nearly five decades is up for grabs. Next Tuesday, Democrat Martha Coakley will face off against Republican Scott Brown, and it's anything but a done deal. Some analysts say Coakley assumed too much, that Brown took advantage of that and of voter dissatisfaction in a recession. And there may be another factor. Some local talk radio has turned into a virtual Scott Brown unpaid political ad.
Vote for Scott Brown. And between now and then, give him a couple bucks if you can. His average.
Every vote for Scott Brown is a vote against the madness. Paul in the car, you are on with Michelle McPhee and Senator Scott Brown. Welcome.
Oh, hey, Scott. Hey, Scott.
And a good morning to you. Tom's all pumped up.
It's great.
What are you all so excited about? Is it the new grandchild? Is it the victory of Scott Brown coming next week?
All sorts of good things happening.
Senator Brown.
Yes, Howie. How are you?
Good, good. I voted for you this morning.
I know, I took
an absentee ballot at town hall, and so did Kathy. You've got two votes out of our household.
Thank you.
We helped Scott Brown for your state, for your country, for your children, and mine. Go, Scott, go. For all of us.
I'm Martha Coakley, and I approve this message.
Even Martha Coakley has been made to sound like she's backing Scott Brown on local radio, a sound of which has carried nationwide. Last week, the conservative nonprofit group American Future Fund took out almost $500,000 worth of negative ads against Coakley. The state and National Democratic Party, meanwhile, caught off guard, have also begun pouring money into ads against Brown. Here Now's Monica Brady Meyerhoff has been following the race. Monica, remind us, it's partly obvious, but why is this so important to both sides?
Well, to the rest of the nation, why it's important is national health care reform, because whoever wins the seat is going to be casting a vote for it. And Martha Coakley, the Democrat, says she will be the 60th vote in favor. Scott Brown says he will be the 41st vote with Republicans against it.
And there's some irony there, this being the seat of Ted Kennedy.
Absolutely. This is the liberal lion of the Senate's dream, universal health care reform. And were the Republican to win and kill health care reform, that would be ironic.
Well, we should say that there is a third-party independent running. His name is, more irony, Joe Kennedy, not of that Kennedy family, not that Joe Kennedy, but he is in the race, however far behind. So give us a thumbnail of the two front runners.
Scott Brown is a state senator who until recently was relatively unknown. He's just been in the state Senate. He's pretty conservative. He's voted against gay marriage. He's in favor of the death penalty. He even questions whether global warming is man-made or natural. He also initially proposed an amendment that would allow hospital emergency rooms to deny contraceptives to rape victims based on their religious beliefs. He says he's in support of Roe versus Wade, but because of that amendment, a lot of people question that.
Well, and you just gave a list that one wouldn't think would be popular in Massachusetts. Let's look at Martha Coakley.
Martha Coakley was a district attorney, now attorney general. She has a very strong record regulating banks and mortgage companies. She defends gay marriage. She is known for protecting children because early on, she, in the clergy sexual abuse scandal, she prosecuted many of the priests accused of abuse, even though earlier there was one priest who she didn't prosecute on one charge. She said she didn't have enough to go with. But overall, she's seen as very strong as a protector of children.
And later on prosecuted that same priest.
That's right.
So there's that. And then there's the personal. Scott Brown is very charismatic. He seems like a very nice guy. He comes across that way. His wife's a television reporter. His daughter was on American Idol. People who know Martha Coakley say she's very warm, very lovely. But on the campaign trail?
On the campaign trail for Martha Coakley, that doesn't come across. She appears distant and cold. When she's speaking to people, she sounds more like she's in the courtroom than she is on the campaign trail. And that's really sort of permeated the campaign since the beginning, even in the primary.
So polls are all over the place, but they're not where, again, you'd think they'd be, given that this is Massachusetts and we just heard the issues and the stands. What are both campaigns saying to you, both sides saying to you about how this happened?
Well, Democrats are admitting they seem to have taken this race for granted. You know, Martha Coakley beat three other challengers in the primary, one of them a congressman. And when they came out of the primary, it seemed like they took their foot off the gas pedal. And here comes Scott Brown. He never stopped for a day. He's got these, as you say, good looks. He was a pinup for Cosmopolitan magazine in 1982. He just seems to be everywhere. And the Democrats say they underestimated him. They underestimated maybe how voters were feeling, too, about issues and not connecting with Martha Coakley. Now, talking to Republican strategists, they say he's surging because of where he is on the issues, that voters are angry about the deficit and health care reform. But I think on the Democratic side, they're thinking this is about strategy and we need to step on the gas now.
Well, and interestingly, polls show that, in fact, many people do side with Martha Coakley on the issues, but not necessarily with her. So they've got that netty problem. Well, now the race has changed, you say. How so?
What's changed is the parties nationally, both sides, and a lot of special interest groups have woken up and seen that a lot of these polls are showing the race closer than we thought it would be. And whether those polls are correct or not, there is a perception this is a tight race. Senator John Kerry is sending emails to supporters calling it a dead heat. So millions of dollars are being poured in these final days for advertisements on both sides. It's suddenly gotten very intense, very dirty, a lot of attacks.
Well, let's take a listen to the ads, because here in Massachusetts, you can't get away from them. Here is one that supporters of Coakley launched just recently.
Who is Scott Brown, really? A Republican in lockstep with Washington Republicans. He'll block tougher oversight of Wall Street. Brown even favors letting hospitals deny emergency contraception to rape victims.
Well, and here's Scott Brown's response to that ad.
Instead of discussing issues like health care and jobs, they decided the best way to stop me is to tear me down. But the old way of doing things won't work anymore. Their attack ads are wrong and go too far.
So, Monica Brady-Meyerhoff, where does this campaign go from here in just a couple of days and less days, because we have a holiday?
Well, we're going to see a lot of advertising over the next couple days. Also, tomorrow, former President Bill Clinton's coming in to stump for Coakley. And on the Brown Republican side, we've got Rudy Giuliani coming in for his camp. And pity the Massachusetts resident who has a landline, because they will be getting a lot of robocalls.
Thank you, Monica. Here now is Monica Brady-Meyerhoff following the race for the late Ted Kennedy Senate seat here in Massachusetts. Well, there's a move in Washington to get a provision inserted into the health care reform bill, which would stop what are called pay-for-delay deals. That's when drug makers pay the makers of generic equivalents to delay the introduction of these less expensive generics. So the generic makers make some money, and the brand name makers get to keep selling their more expensive medications, which they say they need to do to recoup research and development money. But some members of Congress and the Federal Trade Commission want the practice banned. They say consumers could save billions of dollars a year if more generics were available. And that is true. But an old question has resurfaced. Do generics work as well? It's a question that some doctors and researchers are asking, especially since these days 3/4 of prescriptions written are for generic drugs. Leslie Alderman has taken a close look at all of this. She co-writes the Patient Money column for the New York Times and joins us from the Argo studios in New York City. Leslie, you're very clear. You generally applaud generics.
Yes, Robin, I think this is a great point. Generics are fabulous. And for someone like myself who writes on topics of health and finance quite often, generics are a terrific option for people. They allow many consumers to have access to great drugs at incredibly affordable prices. I mean, some generics now are available at, you know, say $5 for a one-month supply.
Right.
So they're terrific. But I do think that it's important for consumers to be aware that sometimes generics do fall short, and especially now that more and more insurers are really making it very attractive to use generic medication. So really gently pushing more and more consumers toward them.
Well, you write about consumer advocate Joe Graydon, who's got a column and a website and has been writing about pharmaceuticals and advocating generics, in fact, for a lot of years. But then he started noticing what he called misadventures that people were telling him about. Tell us some.
Well, Joe Graydon is an interesting story because he has been covering the, you know, pharmaceuticals for many, many years. And he was, you know, a big proponent of generics. But when he started hearing sort of consistent complaints about the same sorts of drugs, you know, he said it was kind of hard to ignore. So it wasn't just across the board people complaining. There started to be patterns of complaints about specific kinds of drugs. And he's been very involved, heavily involved with the FDA and talking to them and bringing the complaints to their attention. So his feeling is, you know, he might go out more on a limb than I would in saying that he just believes that not, you know, some generics just aren't the same as the brand name, and that consumers need to be very vocal in their their complaints when they feel like a drug does not work as well because it's not all in their head.
Well, three of the drugs in particular that Joe Graydon kept hearing about were generic forms of the antidepressant Wellbutrin, XL300, generic forms of the heart medicine Toprol XL, and of the anti-seizure medication Keppra. And he actually had the antidepressant generic for Wellbutrin tested. What did he find?
Well, he found it was an interesting case. He took it to Consumer Labs, which is an independent company that tests all sorts of over-the-counter medications and prescription medications. And he said, hey, could you guys put these two medications to the test? What is going on here? You know, it wasn't – you have to understand also that Wellbutrin, there's several generic forms, but only one was he hearing complaints about. So this was very fishy, right? So he went to Consumer Labs and said, hey – what's going on? Let's test it. And lo and behold, they found that the way the medications dissolved was slightly different, right? These are long-release tablets. They're supposed to release a steady amount of drug over 24 hours. And this Budeprion was releasing a little bit faster, right, than the brand name. So this was of great concern. Now, when they took these results to the FDA said, yes, but over 24 hours, you're getting the same amount of medication.
Yeah.
Now, the problem is, you know, who can really say, right, unless you do a clinical trial, which is actually about to be started any day now, that, you know, having a lot of the drug released right away for many patients seemed to be a problem. They had a lot of side effects, and they felt the drug just wasn't as effective.
Well, that might also be because of the way generics are made and how they're approved. Let's just take a second to talk about generics. They come after a drug patent expires. On a product, companies are allowed to go take the same ingredients and make a generic. But there's something called bioequivalency, and this is sort of a range, very small, but a range in which they're allowed to be slightly different in how fast they get those active ingredients into the blood?
Yes, but the way they'll look at a generic drug is they're not going to test the active ingredient again, right? That's already been proven to work, right? So what they're saying is let's see how these two drugs dissolve, right? Let's test on normal people what happens. So they take the brand name drug and they take the generic form, and they want to make sure that the drug is reaching similar blood levels. But they have to allow for some variation, right? So there's a range from 80 to 125%. The generic drug has to fall within that range when compared to the brand name drug. And probably for most drugs, that bit of variation is not a big deal. Now, when it seems to become tricky is for drugs in which any variation could really actually have an effect on someone's health. And that's when you're doing something like controlling blood pressure, right? Or you're controlling an anti-seizure medication. Like imagine someone who's an epileptic. An extra seizure, that's serious for someone. So that's those drugs seem to be really under a lot of scrutiny right now.
That's Leslie Alderman. She co-writes the Patient Money column for the New York Times, and she's talking to us today about creeping concerns that some generics aren't as effective as their brand name equivalent. So when we come back, her advice, including why you should check to see if your pharmacist has switched you not just to a generic, but to a different generic than the one you're used to. She'll explain why that might matter. Also later today, of course, the latest from Haiti. Back in a minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. We're speaking with New York Times columnist Leslie Alderman about concerns that some generic drugs might not be as effective as some brand names. And Leslie, you were telling us that generics are approved if they provide a similar blood dosage level to brand names, and there's an allowable range of difference. But then within generics, there's difference. So you might switch from a name brand to a generic and have some difference, then switch to another generic and have more difference.
Yes, that's a good point. So that then it becomes a whole kind of tricky thing of you have to figure out what generic medication you're on. And when your doctor sends a prescription in and, you know, it says it's fine for this to be filled generically, then the pharmacy can fill it with any generic. And usually they'll have one generic for, you know, at least a few months and usually longer. But, you know, say they get a better deal, then they'll switch you to another generic, with the idea being that these drugs are equivalent. And for the most part, they probably are. But not always.
And some pharmacists, mine, will put a label on saying, this may not look like the last prescription that you got of these pills. Don't worry. It's another generic. They alert you to that, but many don't alert you. And you tell the story of a bipolar woman. Tell us her story.
This was a very interesting story. It's a young woman who's bipolar, and she's in her 20s, and she was taking Lamictal, a brand-name drug, quite successfully controlling her bipolar disorder. And she'd been taking it for a couple of years, and then a generic version came out, and she was quite happy. Her co-payments dropped from like $45 to, you know, change. And the generic version seemed to work quite well. Well, then lo and behold, her insurer said, you know what, let's make this even cheaper. You must do this via mail order. So she thought, fine, and she mail ordered her drugs. And all of a sudden, they looked a little different. And so she was on yet another generic version. And all of a sudden, all her symptoms came back. They came back to the point where she felt like she couldn't work and wanted to go back on the original drug. Her insurer said no. And what she did is she did a little research. She found the original generic that she was on. She buys it herself from the local pharmacy. She still pays a generic rate. Oh, it's a few, you know, I don't know, it's a few dollars more than she was paying before. And she's fine. She's back to normal again. So here's a situation where two generics were different. And she was, you know, quite convinced that it was this new form of the pill. And it seems like quite a stark example, right? She's not saying, oh, brand name is better. No, she's saying there was a difference for her between the two generic drugs.
Right. Well, your column got a lot of response from readers, most of them sharing their stories and feeling validated. You know, finally, somebody to acknowledge what I've always known. This generic didn't work as well for me. And a lot of the drugs they talked about had to do with drugs to treat depression or allergies. But a pharmacist wrote in to say, you know, it might be patient perception. How much does the placebo effect have to do with this?
The placebo effect is extremely strong when it comes to taking medications. But I think, you know, Joe Graydon points out, well, if it was the placebo effect, you would see this across the board. You wouldn't see patterns. But what he sees is complaints about very specific groups of drugs and complaints about very specific generics. So when he saw that, he said, you know, this is not just the placebo effect. This is not just people thinking they're getting an inferior brand.
Meanwhile, what do drug makers, the FDA, the American Medical Association say about all of this? The AMA, they, you know, stands by generics. Obviously, the FDA does. Drug makers do. In fact, one drug maker went and did a test after Joe Graydon's test we mentioned of the generic for the antidepressant Wellbutrin. They felt it was fine. So how are they responding to all of this?
Well, the FDA is saying, you know, hey, show me the evidence. And imagine the AMA coming out and saying, yeah, there might be a difference. Can you imagine, you know, the consumer frenzy that would cause? So I think the big organizations are taking a more conservative approach and saying, let's wait until we have really good studies. But the problem is, who's going to do those studies? And they're incredibly costly. So I think everybody's in a bit of a bind right now as to how to deal with this problem. And it's really just going kind of on anecdotal information from consumers and from specialty doctors.
So what do you recommend? Because you do have some tips if people have been told by their insurance companies to switch to generics. What should they do?
If you're switched to a generic, if you've been taking a brand name drug and you're switched to a generic, just pay attention. Write down what it is. You can go onto a great website like, you know, rxlist.com, and you can look up your pill and you can find out who made it. Just keep track of how you feel and note what the pill was. And then if you change again, do the same thing.
Keep the packaging, you stress, so that you can know exactly what it is you're talking about. But also you can shop around, as one of the young women that you spoke of illustrated. If your pharmacy runs out of a certain generic, you can go look for it?
Yes, you can call around and you can find out from a website what the name of this is, who makes it and who distributes it, and you can typically find the specific medication that you really like. So you don't have to settle just what for the local pharmacy. And also tell the pharmacy, you know, if you have a relationship with your local pharmacist, say, hey, you know, I felt like that, there was something a little weird about that medication I was switched to, and I just wanted to let you know. Pharmacies will say, huh, maybe it's one manufacturer. The whole globalization of the pharmaceutical industry, things are made all over the world. And so I think it's just quality control is harder than it used to be. And that's for brand names and generics. If something smells funny or looks funny or seems a little bit off, maybe you shouldn't take it. Maybe you should call your pharmacist.
Or your doctor, because you point out that very often your doctor can trump your insurance company. Just an anecdote, I know someone for whom one cholesterol-lowering drug worked much better than the generic. And there was proof. I mean, there's the numbers. And the doctor called the insurance company and said, stop sending those notices about switching to the generic. I want them to stay on the brand name.
Robin, that's a really good point, which is if you are on a brand name drug and your doctor knows for sure from previous experience that the generic just does not work as well, your doctor can write DAW, dispense as written, and that's what the pharmacist has to do. And if your insurer balks, then your physician can write a letter to the insurer and say, this is why I feel that this individual really needs to be on this specific drug. There can be no substitutions. So do join forces with your doctor and make sure that you're getting the best drugs that are right for you.
That's Leslie Alderman. She co-writes the Patient Money column for the New York Times, talking to us about some concerns about some generic drugs and what you should be aware of. But again, she's a big fan of them overall. Leslie, thanks so much.
Oh, my pleasure.
Okay, still ahead today, Pat Metheny's Orchestrion. The latest news is next, though, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Aircraft from around the world have been arriving in Haiti with medical personnel, food, and medicine, so many that the FAA now says no more flights will be allowed today from the U.S. Workers are running into huge problems reaching people trapped under buildings and feeding hungry survivors of Tuesday night's earthquake. Kate Oswald is a program manager with Partners in Health, the Boston-based nonprofit healthcare organization co-founded by Paul Farmer. We spoke with them on the program yesterday. They've done long-time terrific work in Haiti. Kate is at the group's medical facility in the Central Plateau, having just returned from Port-au-Prince. Kate, I know it's hard, but can you describe what you saw?
It really is unlike anything I've experienced. To know a city so well and to come and see it in total shambles and bodies everywhere, it's really startling. When I got to Port-au-Prince yesterday, it was almost dark, and we drove by the National Palace. Thousands and thousands of people getting ready to lay down for the night. There's still a lot of aftershocks, and so people are, of course, really scared to go back into their homes if they're still standing, and others just don't have anywhere to go.
We've seen all these pictures of all these people severely injured. Are they just sort of mixed in with the general population?
Yes, there are definitely a lot of injured among those who are not injured, but a lot of people have started sending caravans up to our facilities in the Central Plateau because they were not affected.
What kinds of injuries are you seeing as people start to come to you from the city?
Mostly bone fractures, legs, arms, serious head traumas. It's making things harder to treat with people being in severe shock.
Well, and we know that you mentioned you were in Port-au-Prince, and we know that there's a makeshift UN headquarters there because we know the old one collapsed. You were the first group to get to this temporary hospital where expats and UN employees and many of the Haitians are being evacuated. What do they need?
They were in need of pain meds. They were in need of more hands, but they had a University of Miami team that was medevacing severe cases to the DR in Miami yesterday. So I was impressed at how much they had been able to pull together with very limited resources yesterday.
What about blood?
Blood is a severe problem. We have a stock out of blood in the Central Plateau. Both of our facilities in Conj and Hench, which are our main facilities, have very little, if no, blood.
Well, Kate, kind of an awkward question. You know, these are people who are injured, who are cold. You know, in some cases it's warm, but not when you're in shock. You know, you need to be kept warm. And are you worried that even though the relief effort has started, that there may soon be panic or riot or, you know, you may have other issues?
In dire situations like this, you really never know. The police force is out in full force in Port-au-Prince, from what I could tell. And most people are still looking for their family members. But it doesn't mean that there couldn't be violence if we can't get help soon to the people that need it.
Well, and you gave us a remarkable statistic as to how important Port-au-Prince is to the entire country of Haiti. People have family members there.
And the worst part has been, up until just a few minutes ago, there was no cell phone reception at all in Haiti. One of the companies is up. I'm actually calling you through that phone service that is working now.
And Kate, just on a personal level, Partners in Health has been in Haiti for a long time. Not to diminish people who are flying in and then will fly out, but you're not flying in and out. How is this hitting you personally to see this?
I'm choking up as you're even saying that because I've been working here for 3 years, and we experienced horrible hurricanes. 4 hurricanes hit last September. We thought that was bad. And the structural violence and poverty that exist every day, and then to compound it with this catastrophe is beyond comprehension.
It feels unfair.
Yeah.
That's Kate Oswald with Partners in Health, the Boston-based nonprofit healthcare organization, which again has been long doing work in Haiti. She's at the group's medical facility in Hench in the Central Plateau, just having returned from Port-au-Prince. Kate, thanks so much.
No problem, Robin.
And Kate tells us every Haitian has at least one family member in Port-au-Prince. To help, go to our website, hereandnow.org. Back in 30 seconds, Here and Now. In New York today, a room full of people who represent $22 trillion are talking about how to put that money to work for the environment. The Investor Summit on Climate Risk at the UN has corralled everyone from U.S. state senators to the world's leading institutional investors to heavy hitters like former Vice President Al Gore and financier George Soros. One of the co-sponsors is Ceres, a national coalition mainly of investors and environmental groups, which aims to make climate change a bottom-line issue. Its president, Mindy Luber, joins us from the UN. And Mindy, what would you have attendees do?
Well, we're not only asking them to do something, but they're asking governments to do something. We're looking at, over the next 20 years, a $10 trillion investment in clean technology. And the private sector is going to end up footing the bill for about 85 or 90% of it. And they're willing to start the flow of that capital, but they need clear signals from the government, a level playing field, and a rules of the road that say there'll be a price on carbon pollution and there'll be a cap on carbon pollution. Then they're ready to roll.
Well, this is you're talking about the idea that companies might be able to get credits for reducing carbon emissions or sell those credits to other companies that aren't able to reduce their emissions. It's controversial in some quarters. The Obama administration has said they hope to pick that issue up in this new session, but so far it hasn't gone anywhere.
Well, it passed the House, but it hasn't passed the United States Senate. A lot of the controversy in some people's mind has been that while putting a cap on carbon pollution, on the kind of pollution we get from fossil fuels, coal-fired power plants, and big old dirty cars, that putting a cap on that kind of pollution is bad for the economy. Well, the first issue is today we've got $22 trillion worth of investors, hardcore capitalists, saying acting on carbon and dealing with climate change is important for the economy. It must happen if we're going to compete internationally and ramp up our clean economy technology. And these aren't a bunch of environmentalists, they're financial leaders.
Well, and of course, the controversy over just that one issue, cap and trade, comes from both sides of the political aisle. You've got people resenting any cap at all, and then you've got others saying, well, wait a second, why should carbon-emitting companies be able to cap and trade? Let's just, you know, make them stop the emissions. So those are some of the questions swirling around that. Meanwhile, as you say, you've got investors waiting to know so they know what to invest in.
You got it. They need to know the rules of the game, and then we'll see more capital flowing. We saw $140 billion last year go into clean tech companies, solar, gas, clean grids. That's about creating new businesses and more jobs here in this country and elsewhere. And it will hurt us short-term and long-term if we don't act.
Of course, one of the things holding up legislation is a concern for jobs. People in various states worried that if industries get shut down, they'll have workers with nothing to do. And I'm assuming, though, that you have investors who say, as soon as you can let us get started, we'll put them to work in green jobs.
You could not be more correct. Right now, we are losing the race to Germany, to China, to Denmark, who are building their clean economies, bringing out more and more businesses and more jobs than we are. The largest solar companies, the largest wind companies, they're not here in the United States. They're in Germany. They're in China. We've got to get on with the job of competing, because right now we're losing that race, too.
How much do the current headlines, though, become impediments for you? We've got both the recession and the fact that the financial world is blamed for the recession, for the financial collapse. You know, financiers aren't very popular right now. And now you're asking people to have faith in them in this, you know, new unknown industry.
Well, I don't want them to have faith in the financiers as much as I want them to have faith in the hardcore science. Then we need to build policy off of that science that says we have to do something about climate change. And then we bring in the financiers, the Wall Street folks. Trust them or not, they're the people with the deep pockets. We want to see them putting capital into the green technology. We think that's where jobs will be created. That's what will jumpstart our economy. And if it also makes them money, so be it.
That's Mindy Luber, president of Ceres, C-E-R-E-S. For more about Ceres, you can go to our website, herenow.org. Ceres is a co-sponsor of today's Investor Summit on Climate Risk at the UN. Mindy, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, we got a lot of feedback from you recently, especially when Stephen Ranella was on the show. His book, American Buffalo, has just come out in paperback. He's a hunter who says the most humane way to eat meat is to hunt it. Sylvia Schultz, a librarian who hunts deer in Illinois, was appreciative. She writes, "I didn't make a kill this season because I passed a shot that I thought might cripple but not kill. I applaud Stephen's philosophy of hunting what you eat. I'm intensely conscious of the animal sacrifice and intensely grateful for it." But Jim Savage was one of many who called hunting inhumane. He writes from San Diego, "To have to slaughter animals as a job is one thing. The person who has to do this difficult deed is compensated. But I'm willing to bet that most hunters don't hunt for food and kill for pleasure. I'm for capital punishment, but I wouldn't want someone who gets pleasure out of it to do it." Well, here are a couple of other opinions. We also recently asked oncologist Dr. Jerome Groopman, "Where are we in the war on cancer?" And in passing, Dr. Groopman mentioned the connection between smoking and lung cancer. But George Beebler from Billerica, Massachusetts, felt he should also have mentioned the second leading cause of lung cancer, which is radon gas, a natural gas that can accumulate in the home. George runs a radon test service. And many of you wrote to correct me after I said Milan, Michigan, as if we were all in Italy. Laura Emerson, who works at Fox News in Toledo, wrote, "It's actually Milan, Michigan." Funny, she adds, "the next day you were talking about Cairo, Illinois, which is spelled like that Egyptian city." And staying with language, George Helmkamp, listening on KCUR in Kansas City, Missouri, wrote after our talk with linguist Jan Freeman, who said rules have been somewhat loosened. George writes, "This 66-year-old guy sprang from his chair and cheered upon hearing that it's okay now to split infinitives. The horizon of retirement has been enlarged. My life simplified. Thank you." And finally, this is Corey Pesaturo, the world champion of the digital accordion, who told us he wanted to make the accordion hip again. Well, who knew accordions would draw so much response? And some of you pointed out that Corey isn't alone. Here's a sampling of other accordion artists you drew our attention to. The accordion sounds of Art Van Dam, Richard Galliano, Guy Kluchevec, and the band Piñata Protest. We always love to hear from you. Just go to our website, hereandnow.org, and click on Contact Us. In 1 minute, Pat Metheny's new sound. It's like an accordion on steroids. That's coming up here and now. Welcome back. You might recognize Pat Metheny's Long Train Home, one of the hits that established him as one of the most successful and acclaimed jazz musicians to emerge in the 1970s. His new project, The Orchestrion, Real Instruments Remotely Controlled. Picture Willy Wonka meets the player piano. Pat explains it to the BBC's Andrew Purcell.
Essentially, all of the instruments are agnostic to who's telling them to do what. They don't care if it's a guitar, a keyboard. They're just kind of waiting for instructions. Tell me when to play, tell me how hard to hit, and tell me when to stop playing. So it's like right now I'm holding a guitar. As I play my guitar, you can hear there's a marimba playing with me. And you can hear that it pretty much as fast as I can play, it'll play with me. That's how most of the music that you hear on the record was made, was from a guitar. Like, for instance, the cymbals. If you get your mic really close, you'll hear that I'm playing a guitar, that the cymbal is playing.
You're using the guitar as a trigger device. It's going into a computer, becoming a MIDI signal, and going back to the cymbal, which, fine.
And you just described it perfectly.
Can we talk about the wind section, such as it is, at the back? I'll describe this to radio listeners. It's a collection of bottles and quart jugs and gallon jugs filled to varying levels with water, like a kind of science experiment that you would do at school.
And literally, it's because I always loved that sound of blowing across a Coke bottle or something. It's that, but sort of expanded to the full range of the guitar.
The obvious question to ask would be, why are you doing this? Because you can play with almost any musician in the world that you want to. I mean, you have played with so many incredibly gifted musicians, both within and outside of jazz, and yet you're choosing to go out on the road with a bunch of robots.
Well, you know, this goes back to, you know, kind of my early childhood. My grandfather had a player piano in his basement that was a source of endless fascination to me, and that was before I was playing guitar, or, you know, I was, you know, 8 years old or 9 years old or something, and would spend hours underneath that thing trying to figure it out. And I remember the smell of it, I remember everything about it, and it was kind of a huge thing for me. And I've carried a fascination for those kinds of instruments, you know, all the way through.
Call this extraordinary collection of instruments that we have here in front of us the Orchestrion. Why did you choose that name?
After player pianos, people got, you know, further ideas of what else might work using that same technology. And, you know, they started tethering other orchestral instruments to it, like a bass drum or a cymbal or a snare drum or some kind of mallet instrument like a xylophone. Still triggered by the roll of paper moving through the mechanism, but it sort of became an expanded player piano. Those were called orchestrions.
How have you improved on those old orchestrions?
The problem with early player pianos and orchestrions were that they did not respond to dynamics. In other words, everything was loud. So you got that thing that anybody that listens to that for more than 5 minutes, you know, runs from the room screaming and wants to kill themselves. What happened in the last years that kind of made me think that this was now a viable form was that various inventors found ways of using solenoids rather than pneumatics, in other words, electromagnets that could respond to dynamics, that made it a much more musical palette to work with.
Well, as we can hear walking around, this does sound like a live jazz band. It does have touch and swing.
Well, for me, the elements of spirit, soul, swing, groove, you know, what it is to make music must be there for me to be interested in it. It seemed to me that this was like a little nook in the lore of music that had really not been fully investigated, and would it be possible for me to invest all of the things that I love about music to that platform?
From your point of view, as a composer, did it take you somewhere that you hadn't been before?
I wrote music that I don't think I would have written under any other circumstances. Not better, not worse, but really different. It sort of wants to be developed. It wants ideas to go further than you would normally go. There have been many times over the years that I've set up a hurdle for myself or a challenge, or it's like, you know, how am I going to work my way out of this one kind of thing, with a guitar tuned backwards and or tuned in a different way, or a new sound or a new platform or a new guy in the band or a new this or a new that. I mean, it sort of makes me have to rethink things from the ground up, and that's certainly what happened here.
The BBC's Andrew Purcell spoke with Pat Metheny, whose CD, The Orchestrion Project, will be released at the end of the month. To see Pat demonstrating the thing, go to our website, hereandnow.org. Well, we leave you with news from Haiti. The Haitian Red Cross tells the Miami Herald that an estimated 45,000 to 50,000 people are dead. The International Red Cross estimates that a third of Haiti's population, 3 million people, may need emergency help. This morning, President Obama committed $100 million to what he called one of the largest relief efforts in our recent history, saying the first wave of U.S. assistance is on the ground.
Search and rescue teams are actively working to save lives. Our military has secured the airport and prepared it to receive the heavy equipment and resources that are on the way, and to receive them around the clock, 24 hours a day. An airlift has been set up to deliver high-priority items like water and medicine.
Other countries are arriving as well, but it took 6 hours to unload a Chinese aid plane today because the airport lacked the needed equipment, and Haiti's main seaport is heavily damaged, preventing ship deliveries of aid. Meanwhile, car horns blare as desperate survivors fearing more aftershocks stand in the road. A UN spokeswoman is describing Haiti as a logistical nightmare. Some of the hospitals run by the French aid group Doctors Without Borders are reported to be unusable. 60 to 100 people are still missing in the rubble of a UN building. Brittany Gingall, a Massachusetts student, part of a university group, is part of some of the good news coming out of Haiti. She has been found, but a member of her group is still missing. Police and international peacekeepers are on the streets, but one man could only watch as someone looted his home.
Now we have somebody here.
There is some person inside the house.
We can't find him. We don't have a loader to take them out.
Although journalists on the ground do report that Port-au-Prince is surprisingly calm, with little or no gunfire or major violence. Meanwhile, Miami-based Royal Caribbean Cruises is waiting for the Haitian government to give the go-ahead for the company to resume sailing to its private resort, which was largely undamaged. The cruise line plans to carry humanitarian supplies on the voyages, but still, a vacation in Haiti now? Again, for ways to help, go to our website, hereandnow.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.